Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast. Hey, everybody, it's David Nagel. Welcome to the Successful Mind Podcast. And today I have the amazing Matteo Messina. He's a Grammy-winning composer who writes music for film, television, and the symphony. His signature sound can be found on many of today's Oscar-winning movies and independent film hits. The beauty of unfamiliar sounds becoming musical is one of Matteo's unique sought-after talents. With studios in Hollywood and Seattle, Matteo and his team deliver a unique style of film score. His style is curiously familiar and always interesting. His energy is ridiculously limitless, and his creativity knows no bounds. He's a dreamer and a doer. He's written over 300 feature film scores and music 30. For over, what's that? 30. I'm sorry, 30. You're right, 30. 30. Yeah, 30. You're on your way to 300.
I would be exhausted if it was 300.
And 200 episodes of television. Also, since the age of 23, Matteo has written, produced, and premiered over 20 symphonies. Each premiere has been a benefit concert for families at Seattle Children's Hospital, and to date, he and his team have raised over $2 million for these children and their families. Matteo is an accomplished writer, a unique storyteller, and a seasoned producer, a dependable man of his business, and one of the generation's most innovative composers. Matteo, welcome to the Successful Mind Podcast, man. It is so great to meet you, and just to tell everybody, for our listeners out there, this will be the fourth or fifth year that I've actually come out to Seattle in November to see the symphony. It's always absolutely amazing, and your the creativity that you bring to these things. I always sit there and I think to myself, because Brandon, who's my podcast director, he's always sitting there telling me about all these different things that you do, and I think, how the hell do you get so much done? So I'd like to start with that question. Like, really, you're a busy dude. How do you get all this done?
Well, that is a good question. I think I found I prioritize focus. And I'm pretty old school in that I make lists. Like on a Sunday night, I go, what do I want to get done this week? And what's interesting is if I go backwards a few steps from that, Sunday nights is what do I want to do this week, which is a list of, you know, all the things that I want to accomplish, list of any meetings, things like that. But then if I go further back, at the start of each year, there's more like the end of each year, I write out my goals. And what's interesting about those is it wasn't until... I mean, this must have been 15 years, no, not that long ago, 10 years ago. I had always had goals and things like that, but
yeah,
I was like, what do I want to accomplish this year? I remember that year I've already written a few symphonies. I'd done a few film scores, but nothing major yet. Maybe this is a little more than 10 years ago. And I was like, okay, I'm going to write out my goals. Like, why not? I should just write them out. And then I was like, well, because I went to business school, I thought, well, I'll write it like a business plan and I'll write out, my summary in the beginning. And then before that, even I was like, well, what's my purpose? So I decided to have my purpose and I wrote it down and it was a sentence long. And then I wrote my mission statement, just like I would in a business plan, that was a paragraph long. And then I wrote out, well, here's my goals. And I was like, well, what do I want my goals? And I was like, well, I'll separate in between my career and spiritual and finance and, you know, relationship, all those sorts of things. And then when I was in those, like, for instance, when I was in career, I remember that year was the year I said, all right, I really want to do a studio film. I hadn't done one yet. I'd done a lot of independent things. And funny enough, that year was the year I was asked to do my first feature film for a studio film for Fox Searchlight Pictures. at the time. And I remember, boy, that next year I wrote out my purpose, mission, and goals again, because I was like, this kind of works. Like I literally went down and said, well, what do I need to do to get to that? And I was like, I know this person, and you know, and I just looked at all the relationships. So I think the way I get things done is I think really big and long, like I think way out in the future. And then what I do is I print that out, and I usually just keep that, my purpose, mission, goals, it's just a few pages long, just inside my briefcase or my backpack. And then whenever I get on a plane, which is almost once a week, I just, in that moment where they're like, hey, turn off all your electronics or whatever, I pull it out and I just review it. I'm like, okay, you know, just see where I'm at. And then on, like I said, on Sunday nights, I just go, okay, this is what I want to accomplish this week. And then beyond that, then it's about having a great team. You know, I'm a big believer in providing a vision and then surrounding yourself with people that are really good at what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. When you were young, I'm curious as to where this creativity and this drive and this success came from. Did you see yourself being this successful when you were a kid?
No, I didn't really. I mean, I think I was just a pretty happy-go-lucky kid. I didn't have any high expectations on my life. I think when I was really young, I was drawn to the piano. Both my brothers, older than I never really went for it, and I was interested in it, so I started plunking around on it probably around 3 years old. But by the time I was like five or six, I was able to kind of plunk out my own little tunes, and I tried piano lessons once, I think in kindergarten or first grade. I think I was like 6 years old or so, somewhere around there, and maybe seven. And I was, I played all by ear by then. Like my friends, we used to turn the radio on and turn it off, and then I would play back on the piano what I heard, which is just having an ear. A lot of people have that. Some people realize it, some people don't.
Right.
And then it was like a fun trick to show other friends, you know, kind of thing, that my friends are like, watch this, watch what Matt can do. But I realized after a while, like the piano, and when I tried piano lessons, I played by ear by that time. So I just wasn't interested in it. Like I'm a very patient man now, but as a kid, I probably didn't have as much patience. And so I remember I was obsessed with the Muppets theme song. And so I brought the sheet music of the Muppets theme song to the teacher and I asked her to play it. And then I played it back for her. And that's what I did for my recital. And then I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. so really that drive, it came from a love of not even necessarily the instrument itself, but a love of being able to express myself emotionally in a way that wasn't words. And that always felt magical and special to me. And it has throughout my entire life. But I never saw myself doing this as a living. I knew that when I got older, I would go to college. I remember my folks, you know, imparting upon us, it's okay, you know, you're going to work in high school and you're going to save up for college. And, you know, we'll help pay for the housing, but you pay for your tuition and your books. And, you know, we had a little thing, and it wasn't are you or are you not? It was just, you are, where are you going? And it was great. There wasn't any massive pressure, but it was just enough to set me up and get myself out in the world on a good foot.
So they planted that expectation in your head early on then, like, this is just a thing that you're going to do.
Yeah. Because they just said, you can make so many things out of your life and you should go out there and learn and travel if you can. I mean, actually they weren't big on traveling. They traveled, but not a lot around the world until later in life. But for some reason, I got bit by the travel bug really early. Cause I think I was an overambitious kid. Cause I was supposed to do like my brothers, which was get a job in high school and save up for university. But by the time I was starting my senior year, I'd already saved up enough. It was supposed to be saving up for your first year's tuition and books, right, and then work the next summer for the next one. And I already saved up enough for most of it because I worked as a grocery clerk and a video store person. And, you know, like I did all these things. And so I decided to travel, and I went and visited a cousin of mine in Spain and traveled around Europe for a bit. And ever since then, I always traveled. I thought it was a great way to enrich my life. And I found it just as valuable as any education.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I'm a person that loves to travel also. Just anywhere that I can go that's new and enriching, I think is absolutely fantastic. Do you feel that you had a positive message for your life coming from your surroundings from the time you were a kid? Did you always have a pretty constructive message, family, friends, environment type thing?
Yes. Yeah. I realize how fortunate I am to have that or have had that.
Yeah.
My father just passed away a few months ago. He was pretty much a true north for me. And my mother passed away about 3 years ago, but I can look back, and my brothers and I talk about how, you know, we think about some of our friends or other family, I mean, we just like how lucky we were to have two really positive, loving parents. You know, they made it their mission to be at least one of them would be at every one of our sporting events. When you have three boys playing soccer, baseball, football, everything, you know,
yeah.
You know, they showed up, and that's definitely something I feel so grateful for. As I got older, I didn't realize, you know, how fortunate that is. You know, I thought it was just everyone, and it's definitely not. And you know, I had some great teachers along the way, but I'll definitely go back to Benny and Kay Messina. Those two are really, and continue to be even after they're gone, you know, positive forces in my life. And when I say true north, just a compass in that when I try to figure out what should I do here, I think about what would Ben have done? What would Kay say? You know, my mother always preached to me. She would always go, "Hey, things are just things. They don't matter, but people matter. Invest in people." That was her thing. Invest in people. And so I've made that, you know, a mission in my life. I always invest in others, and it's led to a very rich life.
Yeah, I would say so. And you have such a giving heart with all the things that you do for other people and for the less fortunate, like the hospital in Seattle. Do you think, did something happen, like, so when you say you didn't realize how lucky you were till you were an adult, like, I would agree with that. You were extremely fortunate to have parents that gave you that much positive direction in your life. I work with so many people that's a major thing that they have to overcome in order to follow their dream, to follow their purpose, to be successful. Where do you think that they got it from?
Where do I think my folks got it from?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm sure so much of it has to be environmental. I mean, there's nature and nurture. We can look at it from two different angles, but I can even look at my grandfather, Skipper, you know, my mom's father. That guy was so much fun. He would get, we'd be at a restaurant and he'd start playing the drums and singing. And you think that might be like, what's this guy doing? It's kind of annoying, but it's not. He would get everybody singing, and that was his spirit, you know? And so she grew up with that charisma, and she had that charisma throughout her life. And I know that charisma definitely was passed down to me, you know? And you know, it's interesting though, with my father, I mean, I knew my grandmother a little bit on my father's side, but not too much. She didn't speak any English. She only spoke Italian. She was from Sicily, but moved to the States. And then what amazes me is how incredible of a father he was to my brothers and I. I shouldn't say I didn't realize. I just never thought about this until my brother pointed it out at his funeral just a few months ago. And he goes, guys, you know, it's pretty incredible to think of how good a dad we had. And his dad died when he was three. So he didn't have a dad growing up.
Wow.
But he gave us the map, you know, and that's, I'm a big believer in so much of life goes back to confidence.
Yeah.
I just have always, my parents instilled, I always joke that they instilled too much confidence in me. Like, I just believe I can do anything, but you know, like a good example is, I think I was around 30 or so, right around there. And I was maybe a little less, maybe in my late 20s. And I was telling my dad about this idea I had for a concert. I'm like, "Dad, I'm convinced the Pacific Northwest Ballet to give me this thing called a scrim. And it's like this semi see-through, scrim. I'm trying to think of like almost like a curtain, but it's somewhat, you can see through it." And I go, "It's 40 feet tall by like 70 feet wide. And it's going to cover the entire front of the orchestra, of the stage in front of the orchestra." I said, "Then I'm going to put a light underneath the conductor. So all you see is this conductor, and you're going to see him like, but it's going to be at an angle. So he's 20 feet tall. And I said, "Then I'm going to have these dancers come out from him like Shiva. And then they're going to come around." I had all these things. And he goes, "Man, you still don't know what you can't do." And I remember thinking to myself at first, I was like, "Hey, I'm an adult. I know what I can and can't do." And then like, it probably took me a few days to realize. And I was like, oh, that was the greatest compliment I've ever received in my life. Is I just don't think about what I can't do. I like to just dream and then let others try to put those limitations on if they need to.
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing, one of the things that I teach people is that nobody else can see what you can see in your head and your heart. Like that vision, that dream that you have, that's yours, whether you believe that was given to you divinely or wherever, you know, the universe, wherever it is that it comes from. But you're the one that's responsible for nurturing it and then seeing it actually play out in reality. And then selling that dream or in kind of imparting it to other people so that they can buy into it with you. But you're the one that has to actually hold on to that thing and see it forward. And like all the people, all the great inventors, the great musicians, the great talent in the world has, like even a guy like Steve Jobs has had the ability to see something that nobody ever saw before and say, if I can see this for some reason, we can do it. And what's interesting about you is that there was nothing there that said that you couldn't, like, especially based on like what your father repeated back to you, don't know what you can't do yet. And if you keep that open, if you keep that part of your mind open, then there's nothing that you can't actually do. There's things that people don't think you can do, but you know, if you know in your heart that you can, then it can be, then it definitely can be done.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what that sparked and when you mentioned that about other people, you know, I may have started playing piano at 3, and I started writing symphony around 23, but I don't read music. So, and never have. So when
you still don't read music.
I mean, I can look at bar lines and I can tell, like when I conduct, I'm like, well, I know I'm in 4/4 and I can see dots. So I'm like, well, I know this, you know, like I wrote it. So I usually know what I want coming in and out, but, no, I don't sight read. My goal is someday when I, you know, start teaching or something, then I'll make it a whatever university I'm at. I'll say, also, I want to go through your music program and learn to read. But right now it's the music is still magical to me in this way. But I had people say, oh, well, if you don't read, like other people aren't going to understand and, or you shouldn't tell people that you don't read music. And I remember a big part of realizing a dream of making these things happen is just not caring what other people think. Because if I cared about what they thought, I probably wouldn't have done it. If I would listen to what people had told me about producing a symphony or moving to Hollywood, and the odds against me, I might not have done it. But I just know that you're always going to have people that are cautious or naysayers, and that's okay. I think it's good to have those voices around you. But if you believe you've got something, then just do it and don't care if you look back. I mean, my very first symphony, I wrote a piece about first love. I mean, as a 23-year-old guy, it was kind of one of the uncoolest things I could do in front of my guy friends to like put out there, like, this is how I feel about first love. And this is my heart. And here it is musically, you know, and put it out on a stage in front of 1,000 people. But I just didn't care. You know, I was like, you know what? I love them. They love me. We'll still be friends, but we might not agree on every single thing, or we might not, or, you know, this might be embarrassing to talk about, but I thought we all feel these emotions. Why not just put it out there?
Right. I remember hearing a story about Jimmy Page before he was in the Yardbirds and then started Led Zeppelin, but he was a session guitarist. And he was it was him and Big Jim Sullivan were the top session guitarists in London. And he's basically still a teenager at this point. And he was doing really well as a session musician, enough to pay for his own home and everything at a really young age. And they bring him in one day and they actually put sheet music in front of him. And he's like, oh shit. He couldn't read music. So he just waited for everybody to start to play and he made it up as he went along and they didn't know the difference. So that's how they cut the tracks. But he said he got red, he got nervous, he didn't know what to do. And as far as I know, he still can't really read music. But to think about the people that have the confidence to be able to pull something like that off is actually pretty incredible.
Well, I think he's a legend and also, but you know, when you're comfortable with your instrument and you're comfortable being additive, to a situation. You know, the thing is, more than that, if you're comfortable with making mistakes and moving forward, that's really what it comes down to. Like, I know so many people that are afraid to put something out until it's perfect. And I go, you know what, for me, like when I'm writing, like, I don't know if you can see the piano here, but yeah. like when I'm writing, like I, oh, it's not on. when I'm writing to a film, as I'm watching the film go by and I play something, I will play the wrong thing. I'll know what I want as I can hear it as it's coming, or sometimes it just kind of comes out of me as I go. But I'll play wrong notes. Okay, go back, fix it. Wrong notes. Okay, do it again. Wrong. And eventually I'm like, okay, there it is. And it might take 6 tries. It's almost like typing a sentence as fast as you can. And you're like, oh, I made some mistakes. And you go back and fix them. It's the same type of thing where like, I have to do something wrong 6 times to get to the right thing almost every single time I touch, I create. So I'm so used to making mistakes and being incorrect. And I also know that occasionally I made mistakes while I'm performing in front of 2,000 people in a symphony hall. And I'm like, I used to be devastated about it. Now I'm like, nobody notices these things. They don't, or they might just go, oh, he intended that. You know, so when it translates to cooking for me, I always say, and a good analogy in cooking is I always say, look, if I'm making a salad, I'll take the grapes and I'll cut them in half and that becomes gourmet. Or if I burn anything, I just call it blackened, you know?
Exactly. When did you know that this is what you wanted your career to be?
Probably around 26 years old, 27, somewhere in there. About 25, 26. I had just written my first symphony, or maybe done one or two, and an old buddy of mine who was going to university, or he was going to art school, and he was studying filmmaking at the Academy of Arts in San Francisco, I think it was. And he said, he's a director now, and he said, hey, I made this film. There's a short film, like 5 minutes long. He goes, well, you write the music. And I went, I don't know how to do that. And he goes, you didn't know how to write a symphony last year. And I was like, touche. So I tried it. And I fell in love. I remember I was like, oh my gosh, like I didn't have to be in a spotlight performing. I just had a candle lit and I was writing in my studio, and it wasn't, my studio was just a basement of a house at the time, you know, like I was living with 5 friends and I just had the basement room and I turned part of it into a studio, and I loved it so much. And I was like, oh, this is incredible. And then I started going to every single film recording session for scoring session. In Seattle, there were a lot of them. There still are, because it's one of the two only non-union orchestras in the country. So a lot of them end up in Seattle. And then eventually I just was like, oh, the story how I ended up down there was, there was this great composer named Angelo Badalamenti. I've got to reach out to him and tell him this story. I haven't talked to him in ages. He was doing a film for a director named David Lynch. And the contractor of the orchestra would always say, hey, to whatever composer, we have this young composer here named Matteo Messina. He just wants to be a fly on the wall, if that's okay with you. And every one of them said yes. No one ever said no. Yeah. And I just stayed out of everyone's hair. And I used to be with the orchestra, and I'd study the instruments and notice how, you know, the viola is being doubled with the bassoons and, you know, different things like that. But then I started hanging out in the booth. And I met Elmer Bernstein, and I met all these great composers, but the best was Angelo Badalamenti. When we met, he goes, stick around afterwards. I was like, all right. And then afterwards he goes, Matteo. And I, yeah, and he goes, come here. And I remember we were in the control room, and he goes, he just finished 6 hours of recording an orchestra, and he has a bottle of wine, and he brings me to the table. It's a high table, and he's opening this bottle of wine, pours himself a glass. He pours me a glass, and he goes, so I hear you want to be a film composer. And I go, yes. And then he goes, do you play baseball? I was like, what? Do you play baseball? And I go, no. I go, I used to when I was a kid. He goes, oh, where? And I go, across the water at a place called, this beach called Alki Beach. And he goes, so there's a baseball field there? I go, yeah, at a field called Barres Fields. He goes, so there's a baseball diamond at this field? And I go, yes. And he goes, so if you went to the baseball diamond to play baseball, what do you think you're going to do writing film music living here in Seattle? And 6 months later, I moved to Hollywood because that was what he was telling me. He's like, just go down there. go down there and do it. And I remember he goes, by the way, when you get down there, he goes, you're going to work for free for a while. And I go, how will I survive? And he goes, he smiled at me and he goes, I'll figure it out.
That's great advice.
Yeah, it was great. It's similar to like my father had said when I was graduating, I was so proud at this business degree. And he goes, it's great. You have your degree. He goes, doesn't mean you're going to do necessarily something exactly in this degree. He goes, don't chase money. He goes, you know, you'll find a way to survive. He goes, it's not like you're going to find some dream perfect job that you're going to love all the time. He goes, but just find something that challenges you, no matter what it is. Because if you're challenged and you're interested, you're going to enjoy it because you're going to spend the majority of your life doing it. So between his advice when I graduated and Angela's advice to get down to Hollywood, I think that was a good formula for me to get started in my career.
That's absolutely amazing. Did you have anybody along the way that discouraged you?
I guess a couple people, but I honestly, I just kind of tuned them out. Like I think one of them was just, being overly cautious for me, as I'm assuming. And another one just like wished they had done it. So they were just kind of poo-pooing what I was doing.
Yeah. So it never got in your head and messed with your own head. You just was like,
not at all. I don't even, honestly, my soundtracks, sometimes I'll write music for a film and then the studio will go, we want to release this soundtrack. I'm like, okay, cool. And then they release it. And some people will be like, oh, I love this. But then there'll be other people, if you look at the comments and it's like, oh, they'll hurt you. And so I just realized, I was like, yeah, this doesn't add any value to my life. So I just stopped reading the comments, good, bad, or otherwise.
I love that. It's the whole idea of you doing it from your heart and then just not paying attention, you know, to those comments really says a lot about you and your character for why you're doing it to begin with. I ask a lot of people, like, what is it that about you where you gain the self-awareness, number one, to have the confidence to do it? So we know that you had a great environment. You know that it made your heart sing when you were playing and when you were creating. Is there a moment in time where it kind of came together where you're like, not like in a bragging way, but in a self-awareness way of like, shit, I'm really good at this? And if so, if there's a time where you can remember that, did you struggle with that at all?
Huh, that's a really interesting question. All right, I have strangely two different answers for that.
Okay.
One, I think a lot of people have imposter, syndrome, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
You feel like you can't believe people are paying you to do what you do because they don't realize you don't know what you're doing, but you do. I think I had that for the first, you know, decade of my career. Well, not when I started doing big, big projects, probably the first like 5 years, probably took me 5 years to the point until I was like, oh, wow, I guess I really am adding value here. I remember I was working on a film and the film was kind of, they were struggling through the cut and they were trying to find the tone. And I wrote something that was not what anyone would expect there because I thought, you know what, this could work or this could get me fired. And it worked. and the director came to me and was like, oh, you saved this. And I was like, wow, I actually really, like, you don't usually hear that in a job. You're just one person that you're, and you're, but it was just a tonal thing. I mean, more often than not, you're working with in a collaboration with an editor, a director, and producers, and studio executives, and the actors' performances, and the costume designers' choices, and the set. And, you know, there's so many things that go into it. So you're part of this team. But I remember in that moment, probably about, you know, 5 years into me doing like bigger like studio projects, that they had very much thanked me, that I felt like I was really adding value. one part of why, when you asked about why I might have confidence in this,
yeah,
I can easily point back to a time in my life. And actually, interestingly enough, if I'll be sharing this same story at the premiere of my next symphony, but when I was 19, I was in a very bad hiking accident and almost lost my life. And I slid down, slid down a hill about 700 feet. part of it was a cliff, the first like 30 to 40 feet. And then it was crazy that I survived it. Like they called me miracle of the month at the hospital that I went to. And I, you know, went in the ER and had survived this pretty bad accident and suffered third degree burns and all sorts of bad stuff. But basically I remember going back down to the place where it happened later on, like a couple months later, maybe. And I was by myself and I went down this dirt road that wasn't used very much and got to the bottom of this hill where I had almost died. And I remember there were a couple of things. You know, I was like, oh, now I understand when people talk about PTSD. Like I really had kind of broken down and was like, oh my gosh, I think I was supposed to die. And it felt very strange. But one thing that really struck me that has stayed with me all my life, I remember thinking that I had disappointed my parents by almost killing myself. You know, like that, and not on purpose, you know, like if I get
right,
you know, and I remember thinking like that was what I had thought when it first happened. Like I remember telling my brothers, don't tell mom and dad how bad it is. I don't want mom to worry. You know, I was like covered in bandages from my neck down to my boot line. I mean, I was just skinned. And here I was recovering and I was by myself at this bottom of this hill. And I realized, I was like, you know what? Cause then I'd already gone through the point where they're like, we don't care. Like, we're just happy, you know, you're alive, that sort of thing. So I'm by myself and I was sitting there and I'm standing in this dirt. And I remember thinking, wow, my brothers came down here like, a couple hundred miles away to pick me up and bring me back from this hospital back home. My folks were living in California at the time. And they were just like, of course, anything you need, whatever, you know, we're here. And, you know, like, I mean, and I had some close friends who all came to make sure I was okay. And, you know, all these things and that really touched me. And I was like, wow, that was incredible. And I was sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, I could end up completely down and out. I remember thinking, I compared it to what if I ended up hooked on drugs or something, you know? And I was like, there's a circle of people around me between my folks and my brothers and these friends, these close friends that would be there even through the worst of it.
No matter what.
And I made a circle in the dirt by myself and I stood inside the circle and I was like, I have these people in my life. So if I was destitute or something went wrong, I could go sleep on someone's couch. They would feed me, whatever it may be. Like I was in essence, I would be taken care of. And then that day I made a promise to myself. Then I was like, I made a decision. I was like, I'm going to be in this circle on the outside of the circle for other people, for my friends and for my brothers and for my folks and I that's a big way that I've approached life ever since then. And I was 19 years old. And I think part of what happened that day as well is I remember going, you know what? I almost died, but I didn't. And I'm not going to do what people think I'm supposed to do. And I don't care what people, I don't care. Because, you know, when I was younger, I wanted to impress my parents or I wanted to, you know, do the right thing. And then I'm like, I don't give a shit what anyone thinks. Like, I'm still going to treat my family and my friends really well. And it's good, but I don't care if they don't like something because it can all go like this. I mean, you and I can leave this podcast, we can get in some cars and, you know, boom, we could be right. Live our life that quickly. And I thought, I'm just going to do what puts a smile on my face today. And I pretty much have lived my life as much like that as I can for the, you know, ever since then. And what a gift it was at 19 years old to have that. And I believe that's a big part of where my confidence has come from, to just go and try things.
You know, you said something that really touched a note with me. I also had a near-death experience when I was 22. I was water skiing on the Illinois River, and I got separated from the boat, and I was sucked through a dam.
Oh.
And I was only one of two people that ever survived going through it, and the other guy that survived was a quadriplegic after that. And it was really interesting because the year before, there were two fishermen on a boat, and the motor went out. And they had no way, like if your motor went out on your boat or you got caught up in the current, there was no cable or anything in front of this dam to grab onto to prevent you from being sucked through it. So anything would go through. And I have this amazing picture I show in seminars of this this huge tugboat in the 1940s that got sucked through. And I mean, things massive, and it was just broken into toothpicks. So these two guys went through, and they got stuck inside the dam. The water had not spit them out. And they sent three firefighters down with scuba gear, and all five of them died. Oh. So this was like a really rough situation. So I go through this thing, I break my back, and I come out the other side, and I'm going down the river, and I could not get out of the current. I was trying to swim to shore. I just couldn't do it. Thank God I had a life vest on, or I wouldn't have made it at all. But I went around this island that had a long branch hanging over, and I managed to grab onto the branch. And as I was hanging onto this branch, my son, who was just born in June of that year, this is 1989, he flashed on the screen of my mind, and I started to cry. And I never said this the way you said this before, but that's exactly how I felt. Like I disappointed my whole family. Like I was a complete disappointment. And I don't know where that came from, but I do know that I was at a very stuck point in my life because I had quit high school and I basically only had the qualifications to work on a dock. And I was driving a forklift, and my life was progressively getting worse. Like we were on food stamps for a period of time, and I didn't come from that kind of a background. So I knew that this was not normal, that I was screwing it up, but I didn't know how to fix it. But that, I had a lot of same experiences that you did because I had a lot of people came to see me also. They also wanted to tell me how stupid I was for swimming next to a dam. I'm like, it wasn't swimming next to a dam. I didn't even know it was there. But it gave me a sense of urgency for my life. Like nothing else, as far as like loss goes or being rejected or anything, none of that even seemed important anymore at that point. It was just, there was an expediency and urgency to do something completely different. But I never really thought about that before as like letting them down. But that was the exact emotion that went through me when I started thinking. You know, they say that a lot of times your life will flash in front of your eyes. And I realized at that moment that if I had died that day, all I left for my two kids and my wife was a bunch of problems. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't okay with me, that I had gotten myself into that situation. So those are interesting things that really give a spin on life.
Yeah, I understand you for sure.
The idea of the accolades that you get, like you won a Grammy. Tell us a little bit about that. What was that like for you to win a Grammy?
It was exciting at the time, and it was fun to be involved in we had a hit film, and we put out music that was kind of something that people had never really heard. I shouldn't say never heard, but the general public had never heard stuff like that. And it felt, you know, it gave people like, oh my gosh, you don't have to produce music out in this big fancy way. It can be really raw and intimate and beautiful and simple. So it was fun to be a part of that and to go for that ride, especially as the film got nominated for Oscars and it won an Oscar. And we would go to all these different events for that. And I remember we would go to all these parties, and I was like, why are we at these parties? And then like, I remember walking into a party and there was literally like Billy Crystal and I'm trying to remember who, like every famous actor I'd ever heard of in my life was there. I was just like, this is crazy. And Hans Zimmer, this composer, came up to me and he's like, oh, I loved your score for Juno. And he told me, it feels like it sits on my shoulder, and we're just meeting all these people. And I was like, this is so fun. And then I asked him, I'm like, why are we at all these parties? They're like, that's because these are all Academy voting members. They want you to rub elbows with the voting members. I was like, oh, I see. Oh, wow. I mean, that was for the Oscars, not for the Grammy thing. But here's the interesting thing. After getting the Grammy, honestly, I remember telling this to some students one time. I'm like, yeah, I got up the next day and I still pooped the exact same way.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't change how I thought. It didn't change how I acted. It didn't change what I did on a day-to-day basis. It was just a nice PR thing to point to for business. But the satisfaction didn't come through an award. The satisfaction came through creating and being a part of something, and then also creating this music, being a part of something that affected people in an emotional way, that when you talk to them, they're like, oh, I love that music, or oh, I love that film. And that continues to be even, you know, really satisfying in my career.
It's an amazing accomplishment. And there's like only so many people that ever really get to experience something like that. And I think a lot of people look at success like a destination. You know, if I could just get to this place or get that thing or whatever, they don't realize that you've got to be better tomorrow. You know, like whatever it is that you're doing, if all of a sudden you were to start showing up and you sucked, the Grammy that you won wouldn't matter. You know, you still have to perform. Which brings me around to Seattle Children's Hospital. How long is it you've been doing this again? I forget the number.
I've been volunteering there for 22 years, and then this Symphony Number 22 will be I guess it's the same amount of time I've been raising money for the hospital. The very first concert I did wasn't for the hospital, and then every one of them since then has been for the hospital.
Okay. So how did you get involved in doing that? What sparked it?
I put up my first symphony, and right when I was about to do it, the guy that books it, he goes, hey, are you affiliated with a nonprofit or 501c3? And I go, what's a 501c3? He goes, it's a nonprofit. And I go, no. And I go, why? And he goes, well, you know, when we're co-producing this is actually a lesser rate on your side of the production if you're a 501c3. And I was like, oh. And I go, hey, if I was just to go find a 501c3, like a nonprofit organization that I feel would be really worthy, could I just do this through them and then take that difference of whatever it was, $2,000 or $1,000, and just give it to them? And it was so great because he goes, no. And he shook his head. And that was his way of saying, like, I can't tell you yes, but yes. And so that first year I did an inner city arts program, and it was great actually, but it was right after that first concert. I was at the time working for a network security startup. I was very interested in e-commerce and the internet, you know, back in the late 90s when I started all this.
Sure.
And the Monday after my first symphony, the CFO called me into his office, and there were only like 30 of us there. By the time I left the company, I think, or by the time it was done, there was like 300, and he called me into his office. He goes, hey, you play piano around town, right? And I literally, I don't know why, but my first reaction, I went, oh no, am I moonlighting? Like, is that okay? And he goes, yeah, we were all at your symphony last Friday night. Like, we all know you play music. Like, of course, it's fine. Because that's one of the reasons we hired you. That's, you know, we like what you do outside of work. And he goes, hey, I don't know if you know this, but my daughter Jordan recently passed of a brain tumor. She was 5 years old. Wow. And he told me their story, and it was just so difficult to hear. And then he said, you know, they have a piano in the playroom at Seattle Children's Hospital. And I always contended he asked me to play. He always said, no. I never asked you to play. I just told you it was there. But just out of being raised by Ben Messina and Kay Messina, or maybe it was the Catholic school upbringing and the guilt, but I immediately got on the phone and called the hospital. And I said, hey, I'm friends of the Ducalo family. And, they told me you have a piano there. I play piano professionally. Would you like me to come volunteer and play piano? And they said, yeah, come down. And they told me when the playroom times were. So I went down there and I didn't really know what I was going to do. So I just went in, there's kids playing and stuff. And so I started playing like Charles Schulz, what's that cartoon? Peanuts. And I was playing that and, you know, just bopping around. And then one kid started hanging out by the piano. So eventually I said, do you want to play? And he goes, sure. And so I plunked him up on the bench. And I put his fingers on C, an octave apart. Like, don't. He's just going, dee-doo, dee-doo, dee-doo. And then I wish I had the piano on, but I played this big boogie woogie, da 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 da, and everything he played was going to sound great because it was all in the same key. And we played a duet. And I ended up doing that introduction with every kid, almost every single one, for 20 years. And then we go on to write songs about bees and dogs and farts. And I always say we forget about cancer for half hour. And sometimes it's a kid going through treatment. Sometimes it's just their sibling. You know, it's a little brother, little sister, big brother, big sister. You know, they're going through a lot of stress. And we just write songs. And a lot of times it's so fun because, you know, it's not like you would ever ask somebody, you know, how are you feeling? And it's not like prison where you're like, what are you in for? You know, but you see a kid with a tube up their nose and, you know they're going through chemo if they don't have any hair and radiation and whatnot. And but here's the thing, like, you wouldn't just directly ask somebody how you're feeling, but I can say, hey, let's write a song. And then I go, what are you writing a song about? And they're like, I don't know. And then I go, well, what are you feeling like today? And I'll start ask them. And pretty soon they tell their story through song. And now we've made something that they can play for their parents or their, you know, their siblings or anyone, friends. And it's about them, and it's of them. And it's a different way to express themselves. And when you say something, you can express your heart in a song and it just seems okay. It's no big deal. But you wouldn't just say, I'm scared.
Right.
But you can say it in a song and it's something that people can relate to. So, and then my volunteering, you know, I was living in Seattle at the time, and then I eventually moved down to Hollywood, and I spent 11 years down there, but I still, every time I fly back all the time, probably every other month at a minimum. And I would always be at the hospital. And then when I moved back up here 10 years ago, I was volunteering there again. And then about 5 years ago, I was asked onto the board of Seattle Children's, they have four, and I'm on the fundraising board. And so I don't get down to play with the kids at the hospital as much anymore, but I also realize my role has changed a little bit because now I'm a father and I, you know, to two young children and also three big kids. And I just don't have as much free time as I used to be able to go hang out and play.
Sure.
So I still get down there occasionally, but not as much, but I definitely serve quite a bit when I'm on the board and mentoring others to help them with their fundraising for the hospital as well.
And, but this symphony's really turned into quite a big deal. I mean, like I said, I've been there four or five times now. I'm coming this year. And the place is packed. Like, it's not just a few people anymore. You've got a lot of people involved in not just coming to see you, but actually giving back to this hospital.
Yeah, I mean, it's just inertia. You know, it's just, you know, roll a snowball down at the top of the hill and see what it turns into. I mean, it's that very first concert was just friends, family, soccer teammates, high school friends, college friends, you know, fans of my band, whatever it may be. And I remember, you know, the very, very first concert, I think I had like 350 people. You know, now we're in this 2,500 seat hall and we can have these huge audiences. And, but it, you know, it's been 20 years. So what's fun is, with people we've grown up together, you know, like I've literally like, people come back to this every year, and I don't just, you know, it's not like a showy thing.
Right.
I literally play what's on my heart and just know that it translates. I never write from a perspective of, hey, I bet people would like this. I just don't. I just write what I'm interested in. And just by virtue of being a human being, I know other people can relate to these moments of joy or fear or sorrow or pain or, you know, ecstasy, whatever it may be, it's relatable. So I just play and know that they're going to feel it. And a lot of times in the concerts, I don't use the word I as much as I would use the word you. And I'll talk to people, you know, when you feel this or you feel that. And then at the end, I'm just like, well, this is why I wrote this, because I felt that too. And then I play, you know, whatever it is with the orchestra. But now they're set up to be thinking for the next 5 or 6 minutes of that piece about their journey in whatever motion that is.
And you get the kids involved. Like, I've seen it like for them?
I don't know. I think it's pretty fun. I think it's somewhat cathartic. I think just 2 years ago, we did the 20th, and about half a dozen of the kids came back, which was really cool. And I stay in touch with almost every one of them. A couple of them have passed away, but majority of them are doing well. And we stay in good touch, actually. You know, one of them, Taylor, went on to, I remember he almost died just when he went through leukemia and he was getting a bone marrow transplant. When I met him, he was on prednisone and it's all blown up. And
and
we wrote this song. His initials are TC, and his family, they called him True Courage. So he and I wrote a song called True Courage. And I go, what do you want to write this about? And he's like, I just want to thank all the doctors and nurses for helping me live. And we wrote this song about what it means to have true courage. And it was out of gratitude. This kid, when he went back to school, he was starting, should have been in high school. They said, you know, he should just do a GED equivalent. And he said no. And he went back to school and he got straight A's, so much so then he got himself into Harvard and he's now graduated Harvard. I wrote his recommendation letter for like a Rhodes scholarship or something. Like he's just an incredible human being. And I mean, I have so many of them that we just, another one, he just sent me a poem that he wrote just the other day. He's like 22 now. And I don't know. We just stay in touch here and there, and we're a part of each other's lives. And I think for them, they get to express how they feel. And there's something great about being known, you know, and accepted. And I think that tends to be kind of a recurring theme of my concerts anyway, is acceptance and that you are known and that you are valuable. And so when this, you know, being a patient going through especially a life-threatening disease, can sometimes be quite lonely because people feel kind of freaked out if you're about to die, or they're not sure. And they're, you know, they just, you know, human beings were somewhat funny around death, and it can get really lonely. And then for them to be able to just tell their story and especially in a victorious manner, you know, it ends up being pretty cathartic, I think.
Do you find, one of the things that's interesting, because I've done work, I haven't lately, but for years I did a lot of work with Make-A-Wish Foundation. Mm-hmm. And we would donate a portion of seminars to Make-A-Wish, especially the chapter out in Las Vegas. And so I would bring some of the kids to the event on stage, and one of the, I think it was a chapter president at the time, and they would talk, and we would talk to the children a little bit. And I was asked to come in and help paint this new room for them and kind of be part of this experience with them. And for me, it was incredibly life-changing to be in there and doing something with these kids. But what shocked me the most was the optimism that they had. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm thinking, because I had never really been in a situation like that, I was wondering, like, I wonder what the mood's going to be. Like, you know, are they going to be down? Are they going to be sad? Like, what is this going to be? And they literally, like, these two little girls took my hands and they walked me over to this wall with this paintbrush and where they were doing these murals and everything. And they were literally excited to be involved in all these different projects that they would do. And I remember thinking to myself, man, you know, so many times we think we've got problems in life and these kids are battling, you know, for their lives, and they can be that happy. They can be that optimistic. They can be that much in the moment of something where it's just pure joy radiating from them. And you know, they have to be afraid and in pain and, you know, going through the horrors that cancer and life-threatening diseases actually bring to someone in their family. And I was just wondering, like, how has that affected your life? How has that touched you witnessing all of the different things that they go through?
That's a good question as well. I've walked through a lot of tough stuff with families through these 22 years or so. And what I've found is, you know, people forget how resilient we are, human beings. I mean, we are a lot stronger than we give ourselves credit for. And I think so often too, when people, you know, see like a kid that's sick, you know, they forget that it's the same as you. You know, like I'll give you a good example that maybe this will help give us some perspective. But like, one of the things we raise money for, it's for this really incredible research curing kids of blood cancers right now in the clinical trials. It's like at a 92% success rate, and it's going to be amazing in the future here. But the other is called uncompensated care, and it basically helps make sure that any child that comes to the door gets accepted, regardless of insurance. And
that's fantastic.
People think like, oh, they're less fortunate. And it's like, no, you don't understand. Like, this is anyone, you know, you have a sick kid, you're going to mortgage your home. You're going to do whatever it takes to help them. And so people think like they kind of put sick kid in this neat little box over here. Like, this is a certain type. That's just you, you know, you can go through that at any time in life. So you have to look at it from your perspective, not just like they are this other kid and, oh, they're so strong. They're filled with all that fear. They're filled with, you know, all those things. But also what happens is you can't just live in that fear. This is so much, well, it's not strange, but so I have a really dear friend of mine, a very, very successful songwriter who just passed away about 3 weeks ago. And he and I was talking to him about 2 months ago. It was only 5 weeks before he got diagnosed, and he died within like 6 weeks. Wow. of a glioblastoma, brain tumor. He's young. He had 41 years old. He had 3 daughters under 6, and it was really tough. And the day after his first treatment, I flew down and he and I went out and hung out for the night. And like, I had to hold his hand, you know, for us to walk to the into this cafe. Like, his vision was a little messed up, and we were just talking about all the things we always talk about, you know, our careers and our life and our families and our wives and, you know, all these things. And then I got down to it and I was like, hey, you know, like, you know, how are you feeling? And cause he was telling me, he's like, well, I'm going to go look at this property. There's this neighborhood I think is beautiful. I would love to try to see if I can get a property over there. And I'm in my head going, my dad just died of the same thing a few months ago. Like, there's no way he's going to, shouldn't say no way, but it's very unlikely he was going to survive this.
Right.
And I go, you know, I go, and he and I are close enough that we could talk about, you know, the tough stuff. And I go, you know, this is a pretty tough, you know, diagnosis. And he goes, look, I can't wallow in it, because I just want to move forward with life. And if this is the time, this is the time. But if not, then, you know, I'm still going to keep moving forward. I'm not going to just feel bad for myself right now. And I was like, oh, that's good. You know, and then he was gone, just, you know, and he and I would talk on the phone every few days, after that. And then I went to call him one day and he didn't answer. And then he had passed. So the thing is, even when you're faced with these dire straits, I guess you can put it, as a human being, it feels more natural to move forward than it does to cower in fear. I mean, human beings are brave people. We think we aren't, but when it comes down to it, especially in these illnesses, we are. And I've seen that over and over with so many kids. But I do see them a lot of times feeling lonely, because you're around especially when you're in a, you know, with a terminal illness, you're around other children that are kind of in and out of this predicament.
Right.
And you'll get visitors, but people really are kind of scared. They're like, you know, that if you do die, they're, how, you know, we're funny around death. So I do see a lot of loneliness in that as well. So it's really important to, you know, be there for those people when you can, for anyone going through illness when you can. Just, yeah. Human touch is so important. Just a hand on a shoulder means the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because you were talking about how brave they are. If people could bring out some of the things that come to the surface for them when they're in a position like that, or when they're watching somebody go through something, I think their overall quality of life would increase tremendously. But whether it's the compassion or the bravery or just the ability to express feelings alone, you know, makes such a difference. And it's one of the things that I admire about what you do, the generosity and the creativity. Always, you know, when I heard you were doing it for 22 years, I remember when Brandon and Liz and Steph were telling me, kind of your story a little bit. And I was thinking, that's an amazing amount of generosity on your part to be able to do that with how busy you are and what it must take. I mean, although I have this idea in my mind that this is such a massive undertaking for you to be able to create one of these symphonies, because they're always so different and you bring something new, you know, to each one. And I was just thinking, in I wish more people could be that way. And it was one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the podcast, was to share your story and your optimism and your enthusiasm for life. So I'm you know, coming to the end here. So I just want to ask you one more question and we'll wrap it up. I ask all my guests, I call it a successful mind life tip. If you could give one tip to everybody that's going to listen to this, anything that's close to your heart that you would feel like saying that would make their life better or make their journey in success better, what would you offer?
Say yes. Say yes is such a, not because you feel you need to, not to please anyone, but say yes to opportunities no matter how scary they are. You know, you are valuable. And, you know, my daughter and I recite this back and forth to each other every night, which is, you are beautiful, you are valuable, you are strong, your words are important. We always say you come from a long line of Messinas, and you are so loved. And I think a lot of times people, you know, there's all these great opportunities in life, but the people stopping you from doing that is you. It's not other people. Yeah. You know, so often I see people when they're struggling with something, it's themselves. It's not somebody else holding them back. And it comes in the form of words of like these statements like, oh, but that would be too, that would be, I don't have enough time, or, oh, that would be too expensive. Or, oh, you know, there's always an excuse. If you ever hear yourself saying an excuse, chuck the excuse and just say yes and just see where it leads you.
I couldn't ask for more. It's been a real pleasure and an honor to interview you. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you, David. You asked really good questions, actually.
Thanks. I'll see you in a month.
All right. Sounds good. Take care.
Take care, my friend. Right. Bye-bye. Bye. Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind Podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.